Good morning and welcome to the Open Systems Media webcast addressing ISO 26262 compliance in ADAS or autonomous vehicles. My name is Rich Nass and I'm the Executive Vice President of Open Systems Media and I lead the embedded IoT teams for embedded computing design. But more importantly, I will be your moderator on this webcast. Today you'll be hearing from David Hawk, a director at Parasoft, and Andre Madan, a senior solution architect who's also from Parasoft. I'll tell you a little bit more about them in just a minute. Let me tell you about today's topic and what you can expect to learn from the webcast. As you likely know, ISO 26262 is the functional safety standard for electrical systems within the automobile. And keeping that in mind, we'll start today's discussion here at a higher level, and then we'll go through what the spec really means. Then we'll dive much deeper in and we'll discuss what ISO 262 will mean to you and your specific design. And then finally, we'll talk a little bit about how Parasoft can help you in this process. But first, let me go over some of the housekeeping stuff. The entire presentation will take about 40 minutes, give or take a few minutes, and that'll leave us plenty of time to answer your questions, and we'll answer as many as time permits. You'll find on your console window an area where you can enter your questions in real time, and as I said, we'll address as many as we can after the speakers are done with their presentation. I encourage you to ask those questions while the speakers are speaking so you don't forget them, and we tend to do them in chronological order. So if you ask one at the beginning, we'll probably answer it first. If we don't get a chance to answer your question, if we run out of time, we'll get back to you after the fact with an answer. So no questions go unanswered. I promise you that. If you have a question pertaining to the operation of the webcast itself, like if the slides are advancing or if there's trouble with the audio, put that question into the question box, and one of the technicians will respond to you as soon as possible. On the console, there's a maximize button that allows you to see the slides in a larger window. And note that this webcast will be available in an archived version about 24 to 48 hours after we sign off today. So if you miss something or you want to go back and review or if you want to send a link to your friends or your colleagues, it'll be there waiting for you. Okay, let me tell you about our two speakers. First, David Hawk is the Director of Embedded Sales at Parasoft, and he spends the majority of his time, or he spent the majority of his career working on embedded systems. He holds a bachelor's degree in computer science and served as an information systems officer in the U.S. Air Force. As a captain, he ran the computer operations floor for the B-2 CTF at Edwards Air Force Base and developed software for the flight test management system. As a commercial software engineer, he worked on several government programs and played an important role in the software technology for Adaptable Reliable Systems Project, which is otherwise known as the STARS Project. And then you'll be hearing from Andre Madan, a senior solution architect at Parasoft, who focuses on tools and methodologies. He spends his time working with customers to identify the best technical and business approaches for efficient testing of heterogeneous applications. Before he came to Parasoft, he spent about 10 years at Medtronic helping to develop embedded systems and test environments for implantable products. He received his bachelor's and master's degrees in computer science from Purdue University. Whew. Okay, enough for me. Let's get into this presentation. Without any further ado, here's David. Go ahead, David. Take it away.
Thank you, Rich. Welcome, everybody. We're certainly happy to have you with us today, whether that's real time or you play this in a rebroadcast. So today we want to talk about 26262. We are going to talk about this in the context of safety critical, and as most of you know, that driver assistant or autonomous vehicles is really pushing the envelope here. So what we're going to do is we're going to just talk a little bit about the industry, and we're going to go over some of the safety critical system challenges and the impact that has on development teams. Then we're going to kind of go into what it means to be 26262 compliant. And we're going to do this, have a little fun. We're going to do this from a project perspective, and we're going to do a little role-playing to kind of go over some of the issues that a team will typically face as they endeavor to get high-quality software that is also safety certified. We'll wrap up with a little bit about us and talk about next steps, and then we'll move into the Q&A. So as for those of you who have been in this industry and tracking this industry, I'm sure that no bullet on this slide is really net news to you. It is a fact that the reliance on software and the ever-present demand for software requirements in all kinds of vehicles is growing. We have a lot of, you know, various data points that talk about why this is increasing and the demand that it has for safety. But bottom line is, there's more software that's happening in our vehicles. And when we look at some of the advanced features that we can talk about related to where our technology is going with software in the vehicle, that remains that drives us to push safety into the utmost paramount for driving that software through certification. The Ford GT, performance engineer, chief engineer Jamal Hamid, recently was quoted as saying that the GT has 10 million lines of mission-critical code. That is a long way from where we started with vehicles even 30 years ago, where I think we were at somewhere below 8K that was in the first ECU. Anyhow, all of this means that the there's more software and there's more demand for safety critical, and this is driving up costs. The costs are happening for a variety of reasons, let alone the kind of dependency and complexity that we have when we're producing and designing software, but then following that software into a safety critical standard like ISO 26262 has some very specific demands on the team, their tooling, and their process. So we're going to talk about that today. For those of you who were with us in our last session in September 22nd, we actually covered a related topic for MISRA 2012 compliance. And for those of you that weren't able to attend the webcast, and because it has some relevance for what we'll talk about today, we'll just give you a brief reminder with two slides. One is that MISRA compliance is actually a framework for a project. It is a negotiation between the software developers and the team that will be accepting the software. So there's a few things that are required that as MISRA has evolved. There's a guideline enforcement plan which actually shows how the guidelines are going to be verified. There's a variety of ways to do it. Data code analysis for most things is very common. There's a recategorization plan. So if you've got if some of the requirements don't apply, you can actually document that in a recategorization plan, and you can change the specificity for which how that rule is actually followed. There's also a deviation report, and that is important for understanding what has happened for the project and where the exceptions for violations are documented. And then finally, there's a compliance summary, which actually shows the overall project compliance. These four artifacts have to be produced when you're moving forward with MISRA, and it's all things that we can do using our technology. Finally, you're going to see a little bit more about this today as we talk about 26262, but the dashboards for compliance are awfully very important because they're very important for the development team and especially for the managers. We need to know where we are on the project and whether or not we're tracking to success for the timeline for the software delivery. Being able to not only look at the summary but to drill in to understand where the compliance has not been met, actually down to rule violations, is a critical aspect to teams that want to be highly productive and follow the safety standards like MISRA 2012. And again, these things can be implemented within our technology. So Andre and I are going to have a little fun with you today. We're going to take on some roles. I am going to be a manager of a project team that has safety critical code that has to follow 26262. Andre is a senior developer who has been with the engineering team for many years and has actually had to uncover some of the obstacles to achieve those goals. So we start out with I'm the new manager, and I actually went to a workshop. Like many of you, you know, I don't think they do the binders anymore, really. The Stillbird is a little dated. But certainly for those of you who have gone to large training, you know that you come home with a lot of information, and you say, I'm going to get back to that, and sometimes you don't. So anyhow, setting up our role play a little bit, I went to a workshop on 26262, and an overall setting for this is, for those of you that know, the IEC 61508 is functional safety that applies here. It's for electrical, electronic, and programmable electronic safety. It is a high-level standard that primarily was focused on process, and it assumes that a company basically is doing everything. Unfortunately, in the diversity of ways in which software development occurs today, that's really not well-suited for distributed development that often occurs within the automotive industry. So there was some adaptations and some specifications made which derived the ISO 26262. It's still applicable to the 61508, but it's specifically for road vehicles. So anyhow, back into role play, I went to training, and I learned a couple of things, and I'm going to share them with you. Number one is that the way in which the requirements are put together is a framework which is used to organize them around capabilities that are or abilities that are exercised during the software development process. What's often called the V model. These areas around anything all the way from requirements to coding back up to system testing, these are detailed in Section 6 of the ISO 26262 standard. Sorry, you know, when you say 26262 too many times, sometimes you add some extra numbers. Anyhow, it while it maps to a process, it actually does not dictate one. It can be mapped to anything from agile to waterfall. But what it does, and what's very important about what 26262 does, is it imposes constraints. There's additional rigor that's focused on safety. This impacts the tools, it impacts the artifacts that are produced, and the techniques that are used during the development of the safety critical systems. Just for clarity today, and to give focus to what we'll be talking about, we're going to be focusing on the code, unit test, and integration test part of the Section 6 from the standard. So one of the other things that's often talked about and is very relevant to our discussion today is something called the ASIL level. And this is, while you would think it would go top to bottom, it actually, ASIL A is actually the lowest safety critical standard, and ASIL D is the highest. And if you can tell from the chart on the left, something like an autonomous vehicle that has no driver in the loop is going to have an unbelievable set of safety standards that must be practiced when developing code and testing code and documenting what is being done for the requirements related to the software that goes into such a vehicle. The ASIL, while it doesn't necessarily map directly one-to-one, for these different criteria, whether that's an ADAS or whether that's just a standard controls and infotainment type of software that's deployed, you can tell that what was going to have the impact is how much of the software is dependent upon the safety of the individuals in or around the vehicle. One of the things that I learned from training was that the cost is an order of magnitude when you go from A to B to C, where following a process for an ASIL A for a low safety critical environment, when it's applied to an ASIL D, that could be 1,000 times the cost. And back to our conversation just a moment ago, this is one of the things that's driving this. So these are some of the things that I learned from the training. It sets a little bit of context for our discussion today. And one of the things that I learned, and Andre, I'm now the manager that's come freshly back from training, and I learned a few things about the process and some of what we have to do for the requirements, and I see where our project is headed, and we're certainly going to have some safety concerns. One of the areas I was thinking about was unit testing. I saw that we had to do unit testing, and in my last role, the team that I managed, we did unit testing, and we did a pretty good job. Some of our team was using Google Tests. Some were tracking things through the debugger. Some had built some homegrown unit tests, and we were doing okay. We found things that were important. And my question to you is, is that actually good enough for us? Is it okay to have some unit testing and just make sure you know how you're using it?
Right, right. So I'm actually really glad that you went to the training first day in the job, because that will be important for you to understand some of the frameworks and the tools and methodologies that we have to apply here internally. I want to make one comment on the slide that you have on the V diagram. The V diagram, I'm sure managers are all not aware of it, but the section 6 is actually has to do with software only. So today I want to brief you, Dave, on a few things that we're doing around software, even though the V diagram covers things from requirements to the system test with the hardware in the loop, so it's a wider spectrum. So today we're just going to talk about software. Don't get your manager hat all wrapped up in hardware for now. Okay?
Okay.
All right. So once we establish that, unit testing. So it's good that you mentioned that, because it's a complicated topic when it gets to being compliant with a safety critical standard like ISO 26262. And we need to digest some of that, but let me just take a step back here, and before we dive into the specific details of the standard, I'm going to tell you a little story. So in the past, I've been working here for 10 years, and in the past, we actually used the open source frameworks like Google Test. We actually used Google Mock, and we used GCOF to collect the coverage. So we did it in the past.
You did. So why didn't that work? I really like the price of open source and free.
I'm sure you do. Yeah, so we went down this route, and actually it did work for us pretty well. We were able to successfully create unit tests, run them, collect code coverage. It started to fall apart when we got this new requirement to being compliant with a safety critical standard. Right, so my developers were spending time to integrate various technologies together. We needed to spend time to get the coverage from the target. Developers were busy writing integration to create the reports that are required. So I ended up paying them for doing a lot of work that I couldn't afford to do, because they were busy developing the features that we would have to release in the field. So you see here in the screen there are some methods for software unit testing, and there are some methods for deriving test cases. Let's digest some of that in more detail, right?
I get it. So you're telling me that we've got to look at more things, and maybe we need more ingredients in our process.
Exactly. So right off, I think it's you're hungry, Dave. I think that you want to go out for lunch already. So you start thinking about food. I get it. You know, managers go out for lunch quite often. So, yes, I actually like to cook myself. And when I think about unit testing, I think about all the ingredients that have to be there for a successful unit testing framework to be applicable for the safety critical standard like ISO 26262. So, what are those? Over the years, my team has found that there are several things that are important. What's important is you want to be able to create the test fixture and create the test, start creating them faster. Okay? So that's something that we've been looking for. That's what makes the developers more productive. Another thing is, once we created the test, then what? We needed to be able to isolate the unit under test efficiently and give developers visibility into that isolation. So we start looking at stubbing framework and what makes a good stubbing framework. Then we want to be able to give the developers chance to be more productive by integrating the unit testing components, the frameworks, the workflows into their IDE, so they don't have to context switch between the applications. We also found that the framework has to be scalable. So once we start scaling our projects, adding more people, adding more code there, we start thinking about the scalability in the context of, okay, how would we automate the tests? How would we run them on the context of the continuous integration workflow? And also, how would we scale the test cases? Can we, let's say, data drive some of them? Can we use some of the, like spreadsheets or some other ways of inputs and outputs for the unit test? And more importantly, we start thinking about, okay, how would we collect code coverage? So all of those ingredients actually are great, but then once we kind of put our thoughts together about getting all of that done, we turn to the Section 8 of the ISO standard, and it talks about tool qualification. So your framework has to be qualifiable for the intended use. So it's not that simple. When you start talking about unit testing, it has a lot of angles. It has a lot of ingredients, so to speak. All right, so I know, Dave, you like colors. What you see here, a whole bunch of text for you, that's not important, but what's important are the colors. So you see in green, I highlighted specifically for your manager's brain, the some of the things that we have to do here internally, because some of the modules in our software stack are actually AC level D. So, and there are some methods that we're applying create unit tests for those. So since we know the types, the software knows the types, we can automate generation of the unit tests to cover the boundary values. Some of the requirements, not all, but just a subset of requirements, can be mapped all the way down to the unit level specification. So we have to find a way to cover those requirements and build a traceability matrix for those. The interface tests, you know, the interface is just a function signature, so we're using the interface test actually the most often here. And then the important thing is for those is to satisfy the coverage criteria. We're also doing the fault injection tests that we're going to cover. And then while we're executing all of those tests on the target, we have the ability to monitor the memory leaks, to monitor some of the OS calls there while executing a test. So those are some of the methods, specific methods that we're applying here internally. All right. So let's just start digesting it. I know that, Dave, you see on the screen here, there's a lot of code. What you have to focus is colors. So there are two colors here. The first color is green. You like green, right? And I know you do. So that's the most favorite color of all the managers. And here I highlighted some of the auto-generated test case that covers the boundary values. So we're getting the mix and max values for a specific type, and the software helps us there. So the tools can automatically parse the code, figure out all the types that are used as the inputs, and figure out all the types that are used as a global variable, and preset those values for us. So that's how we get around get the fulfillment of the requirement for the boundary values. So another thing here highlighted in sort of light brown here is the heuristics that also the tool can suggest us the test cases that would cover some of the branches there if it understands the logic. Right?
Okay.
Okay. So that's pretty cool, right? So now, a lot of things that we found is the developers still want to be able to write unit tests manually. And we have the tooling here that makes them more efficient. So we have some of the wizards, and with the wizards, creating new unit tests is, you know, as easy as 1, 2, 3.
Wait, Andre. So if it's that easy and I can push buttons, you're saying that I could do it. Maybe we don't have to hire that other engineer you've been asking for.
I'm not sure that's easy, so I wouldn't push it that far, Dave. As you see here on the right-hand side there, there's still a lot of code to digest. So, yeah, let's just hire the engineers to do their job. So on the right, on the left-hand side there, you see that there is a wizard. And the number one says, okay, you need to configure the unit tests. So inputs, you need to configure the inputs and expected outputs. Then you push the button, number two, and then three, your unit test appears there. So it's a relatively straightforward process. There are other wizards that are available in our tooling infrastructure to help you quickly create a unit test, give you a quick head start. But some of the engineers, they actually start writing them from scratch by copying and pasting. You know, that's also normal practice. There is nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with that. All right. So another challenge that we run into here, Dave, is the fact that some of the algorithms and modules that do the signal processing, A to D converters and whatnot, they require millions of inputs and millions of outputs to be used in the creation of a unit test. So we have to test a wide range of inputs and outputs. And that's a very common problem. Not all the unit tests are like that, but there is a fair amount of them in some of the domains, especially the modeling domain, where we have some tests, we have some code that is created by using models like Simulink, for example. And then the what the engineers do, they test that on the host, they test it within the context of the Simulink simulation. But then when they generate the code and they want to exercise the same test cases on the target, they ended up just dumping the data in like an Excel spreadsheet format and then tying those vectors, test vectors, to the test case and executing them on the target. Very powerful methodology to verify the software on the target in the model-driven development.
Interesting, Andre. You know, I had a discussion with Henry down at the lab, and I was relaying to him that every time I back out of the garage, I'm kind of busy with my coffee, and I keep it in the trash can. And he said he was talking about this. He said something about our new LIDAR and radar system could detect an object, and he said something about test data. I didn't understand him then, but I think I know. I think I know now how to respond to that inquiry.
Oh, good. Yep, I know Henry, so I can tell him about this method.
Well, okay, so that takes us to I've even got notes on my slide that tells me what to ask about. This is good. I went to training, right, and we were in a room full of managers, and they started talking about fault injection, and I'm pretty comfortable with that. We just call it the blame game. That's where we blame the fault on another group than when a project is going behind, but I don't think that's how it applies to ISO 26262.
Yeah, it actually has nothing to do with the manager blame game, even though I'm also familiar with that game. So fault injection. Let's digest what it is, right? Because it actually is a very complicated topic, and since it has to be done for the AC level D modules, so we need to get into the details. So here's some of the examples that we ran into with the fault injection. We have the green thing there, the big green square there in the center, or almost in the center, that is the unit under test. So I know, Dave, you like colors. So the green is something that we're testing. And now that little unit under test actually reaches out and talks to the hardware layer. Like it talks to the hardware driver and it says, hey, write some data for me. The analogy for that, Dave, would be when you write me an email and to ask me to do something, and let's just say that, you know, the email server is not available and it's down, so you cannot really write me an email. So what do you do? What are your actions? Do you just get up and walk to my office and tell me that in person? Do you just go home and do nothing? Do you resend that email 2 hours from now? Do you send me a fax? Do you send your secretary to go tell me to do work? So, you need to test that scenario. So we have a fault, and there are other consequences of that that we have to test. So the second scenario looks familiar, right, Dave?
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah, so the second scenario will actually sound a lot more familiar. So when the unit under test wants, let's say, to get some resources, so let's say it's doing malloc, it needs some memory to create some data structures. What if malloc failed? What if there is no more memory available in the system? How would I explain this to you? So the analogy would be, I guess if I come to your office and ask for a raise, and you deny me a raise, what do I do? Do I quit my job? Do I start, doing kind of throttling my work, kind of gradual degradation of performance? Do I try again? Do I do what? Do I just go home and cry? So there are scenarios that will be required to be tested. All right? So makes sense? How we are doing. So basically what we're doing here, we are doing the fault injection using stubs. So instead of the write data here, or instead of a malloc, we are going to stub them out with a stubbing framework. And over the over the years, we found that we accumulated some knowledge of what would be the good stubbing framework for a safety critical workflow. Because there are some of the requirements that can be achieved with some of the open source frameworks, and some of them are really hard to achieve, and some of them are not even possible to achieve. So over the years, we accumulated some tidbits of knowledge, so I'm going to share that with you. So a good stubbing framework, useful stubbing framework that can be used in a safety critical workflow, will have to have a way for you to control the stub behavior. That's a bullet number two here. You want to be able to have a flexibility to set the return values, function parameters, those are normal things, color object state, but also ability to control the parameters based on the stub count. So how many times the stub has been called from the unit under test. And you want to be able then to verify that all of those calls, the data being passed, the actions that the unit under test performed on the stub were actually correct per specification. Remember how we can trace some of the requirements of the unit to the some of the actions that are done by the unit to a requirement, to a specification. So that's where it's very applicable. So in general, the stubbing framework has to be very flexible and non-intrusive. When we started our project, I remember that we start putting extra code there. So we had like two versions of every function, one is stub, one is not. And then we got to kind of muck with the linker, create special make files to build. And then it was still very intrusive because we ended up with a lot of pound defines in the code. It was kind of a messy process. So we found that if we are looking for a commercial stubbing framework, we want to be able to non-intrusively create those stubs. So it's seamless to the user, and also seamless to the build process. So it's very important to show the auditors too that level of flexibility with stubs. All right, so we covered the stubs in kind of a high level. Now let me give you two concrete examples of in our tooling how we are. How we're using the stub. So there are two things here on the screen. The on the left, you see here that I'm showing you the stub configuration from a test case. So we can have either graphically, we can specify either graphically via the GUI or in the code there, what are the actions that the stub has to be performed, and we can do it directly from a test case. Or we can do it in the stub. So we have a flexibility to specify stubs functionality from either the test case, or we can structure that on the stub so the stub can be reused across multiple test cases. All right, on the left there, another issue that we ran into is the fact that developers don't always know what is stubbed out, what is not. So they ended up putting a lot of printfs and stubs, saying, oh, I'm stubbed out or I'm not. And that visibility, and they were wasting a lot of time trying to figure that out. So the graphical wizard here that is on the right is showing you inside your IDE a given snapshot of what is stubbed out and what is not. So you see that some of the functions there, that says original, it means that they are used from the original source, from the original definition. And then some of them are stubbed out. So it's very useful characteristics of a tool for us.
Excellent. All right, Andre. Well, I get it. Stubbing's important. And you may be surprised to know that I also understand that it's got to be used for testing fault injections. It's a very useful way to do it. I do remember from our last shop that they use stubs as well to increase some of the code coverage. So I learned in training that 26262 also has some requirements for code coverage, data that has to be collected during testing. And you know, back to my favorite color, green, and saving money, can't we use something open source? Can't we use this like something like GCov and collect those metrics for our project, Andre?
Oh, I'm surprised that you know so much about this topic. Pleasantly surprised, I must say. Yeah. So unfortunately, while you can still limp along with the open source frameworks to create unit tests, to isolate them with stubs, somewhat of successful, you kind of can have some ways to run them on a target. With the code coverage, you got no options. GCUP simply doesn't give you the level of code coverage that is required for safety critical standards. It doesn't give you MCDC. It doesn't give you some of the other coverage criteria that we absolutely have to have. So to me, this is a showstopper. So you got to use some of the commercial tools like we're using here in-house. All right. So I just want to give you, Dave, a little bit of more color about the tooling that we use and how it actually being configured to achieve the coverage. So here in blue, you see the highlighted rectangle here. All of the coverage metrics that the tool supports, you can enable for a given run. So you can enable MCDC coverage. You can see that you can enable call coverage. You can do trace function coverage. The interesting part, Dave, is that for unit testing, MCDC is required for us for some of the modules. For some of the modules, just a statement on branch is required. So it gives us really flexible way of turning on and off some of the coverage levels to cover certain modules for a given ACL level. Another thing that it gives us is ability to reuse the same coverage framework for integration testing. You notice that in your training, perhaps, the coverage levels required for the integration testing is different than the coverage levels required for the unit testing. So here, you can turn on and off when you're running some of the, when you're expanding your units, unit tests into the integration tests, which is fairly easy to do because unit testing is just code. You've seen that. It's an X unit format. And then a lot of people are actually using that method to expand the unit tests into more of a integration tests and then collecting the coverage of those, hence fulfilling the requirements of the ISO 26262, not only for the unit tests, but also for the integration test. And it's fully compliant then because you're collecting the code coverage. All right, so here we have, code coverage.
Andre, I got in trouble at work. Apparently 3-hour lunches are not okay. And so I ordered Amazon Fresh and I was waiting for my lunch and I was browsing around on the development site. And I found this, and you know I was attracted to it for one, it had colors, and it looks like a dashboard that even a manager could consume. Can you explain a little bit about what I'm seeing here? Is this, in particular, you know, I learned that requirements traceability was part of the requirements for ISO 26262. Is this going to help me?
Yeah, it is a dashboard to show your requirements traceability, and you're right. When you start diving into that. Dashboard there, you see that some of the drill downs will show you the details. So there are two things that, for example, this particular screenshot shows you, how you can trace and show that there, some of the tests are traced to the requirements, so it gives you the traceability matrix. And another data point that it gives you is execution status for a given build. Did it pass or fail? Very convenient matrix here.
Okay, all right. Well, that's good to know. There was one other aspect that we got in our manager training, and that had to do with tool qualification. I think it was in Chapter 11, in Section 8, and it talks about what you have to do for tool qualification. Do we need to do this, you know, for our tools that we're using?
Unfortunately, we do. Unfortunately, we do. So that's actually one of the things that we had to think about when we were playing around with the concept of using open source tools for ISO 26262 requirement. We would have to budget for tool qualification, and that was a very complex and very expensive task, actually, because the ISO has very stringent and very, I would say, laid out and defined requirements about what methods they needed to be applied for the tools. So you see here colors, and the color is green, the color is yellow, the color is red. So and you see the acronyms like TD1, TD2, TD3, TCOL1. So let's just digest some of it just for a second. The tool detection, it's the TD, means basically you need to know your tool confidence level. So it's a two-step process. The first, you look at all the tools, and for every tool that you have in your arsenal, you have to define the tool confidence level. Can the tool potentially find the safety-related issue? And another is it possible for a tool to be wrong? So the worst situation is that you rely on somebody, like a vacuum cleaner, for example, to find all the hair for the dog if your daughter is allergic to it, and the vacuum cleaner doesn't pick up all the hair. For example, if I do rely on a vacuum cleaner, I know that the vacuum cleaner can find all of the hairs on the floor, but then I do it, I actually apply the tool, or in this case the vacuum cleaner, and then it doesn't pick up all of it. So that presents a real safety issue for my house. So TCL3, once you define all of your the TCLs, now you take that information and apply the second step, which is finding the method, identifying the method based on your TCL, and an ASIL level, you find the method. So for us, the method 1C was the applicable for some of the modules, and the level 1B was applicable for another set of modules. So method 1B is just the evaluation of a tool development process. The software, the tool that we use in-house, it's TÜV certified, so we were able to just show that method 1B was applied by relying on that certification. And the method 1C is validation. So we had to actually apply that, create that certification, run through the validation process. And the qualification kit for our tool that we use here is basically gives us that. It outlines all of the things that have to be present, like use cases, test cases for a given standard, what we're using here, and the qualification documents that are created as part of that qual kit.
Andre, looking again at the requirements and some of the stuff I learned about, static code analysis was in there. I think we implement MISRA C 2012. Is this a valid method?
Yeah, actually, MISRA C is perfectly valid method to cover that requirement. The thing is that you need to do what makes sense. And in a lot of cases, MISRA C, we know that MISRA C is not really required by the ISO. It's suggested. So in a lot of cases, my engineers ended up using more rules above and beyond what MISRA C plus C 2012 provides. The tool that we use has actually parts of C++ test, uses the 362, I believe, rules to cover MISRA, but it has more than 2,200 rules in the arsenal. So our developers were able to choose more rules because for some of the flow violations that are not covered by MISRA and some of the coding standards that we have internally here are a lot easier to validate and verify using the tool that we have.
Andre, my brain is beginning to hurt. We've got all these different, what you said, over 2,000 rules. We've got static code analysis. We've got unit testing.
Right.
I've got a stub. I got somebody to blame with fault injections. I got code coverage to collect. Honestly, how am I going to get my hands around this? Is there some way for me to understand what's going on?
We got what you see on the screen, Dave, is a solution to your problem. We got you covered. We have flexible dashboards that show you visibility in a very abstract way with colors, with high-level pictures, with high-level numbers there that gives you, the manager, the insights into the overall picture of development testing process, starting from how many static analysis violations we got, starting from are we compliant with MISRA, and then going to the unit test, showing you the coverage, showing you the graphs, historical representation. So we got you covered, Dave, so don't worry about it.
Oh, thank goodness.
All right, so as a summary, just some of the suggestions when you start implementing the unit testing practice to be compliant with the safety critical standard, like ISO 26262, you got to think about the ingredients that are necessary for a good unit testing tool to have. You have to be able to build the test faster, how to isolate, think about the stubbing. It has to be scalable, both from the data perspective and the automation perspective. It has to report required coverage level for your safety requirements. safety level requirements. You got to support on-target execution. ISO actually suggests that you have to run tests as close to the real environment as possible, and you want to be able to run your tests on target. You have to provide visibility to auditors, like generate the required reports, to management, like you see in the dashboard, and to the developers to integrate with inside the IDE and to integrate inside the workflow. And on the top of that all, it has to be qualifiable for intended use. So you cannot just write, you cannot hire your sister to write the tool for us and then just use it because, I don't know. I like your sister, Dave, but we got to have qualifiable tools.
Andre, she's going to be heartbroken.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for giving us this. Stepping out of role, folks. Thank you for your time as we went through this little journey. The screenshots that we were showing as we were talking about some of these things that have to be accomplished for following 26262, we're using our Parasoft C++ test product. The capabilities that we talked about were just some of the things that we can do to help alleviate some of the pain involved and taking out some of the tedious steps within testing for an embedded system. As Andre just went through very, very succinctly here, there's a lot of things that are required for a tool and the way in which it's used and the way that it's applied when you're looking for a safety critical system like those found in autonomous vehicles. And it's things that we can help you do. For those of you that have been enjoying our comedic series on such somewhat dry topics such as safety certification, we will be having one on November 15th where we're going to talk about certification within an embedded software development lifecycle. We'll be talking about some of the things that we've talked about in our first two sessions and expanding that into a little bit about how it's helpful within a workflow and some of the things that has to happen from a team perspective. So that's upcoming. Please register if you haven't already. If you want to learn more about us and what we can do, you can go to Parasoft, software at parasoft.com/embedded to understand a little bit more about what our technology can do. And from there, you can actually click a link to customize a demo for your environment. With embedded, it's often about what platform you're using, what operating system, and what chip you're targeting, and what compiler. If you want to reach out to us individually, our email address is here, as well as my phone number. We're happy to hear from you about questions or things that you might like to do with our tools in your environment to help accelerate your certification process for 26262. Finally, I just want to thank you for your time today, and with this, we'll toss it back to Rich Ness, and we'll open up the floor for some questions.
Well, thank you very much, and the very first question is, are you guys available for weddings and other kids' parties?
Is there safety involved?
Always, always.
Yeah, I think so. Maybe we can monitor the punch or something.
Very good, very good. All kidding aside, that was very informational, and I know I learned a lot, and I appreciate the way you presented it. Okay, so we have some questions that we have to get to. Let me grab my glasses, and we'll go through the list one by one. It appears that they are directed at one of you, but you're both certainly welcome to chime in on any of these. Okay, starting from the top. As an organization, we see very little value in mandatory unit testing. Well, that's a little discouraging. What we found is we are spending a lot of time maintaining unit tests instead of focusing on testing out real defects. The only reason we are still doing unit testing is that it's required by the ISO 262 standard. Can you recommend how to bridge this gap? This is for Andre, but like I said, either of you are welcome to answer.
Yeah, so it's actually, let me digest that question for a second. It's actually a very common question because people see value in unit testing when it gets to compliance, but they are spending a lot of time just writing unit tests just for the sake of writing them to be compliant. So they're in this kind of a, almost like a rabbit hole where they are keep doing and keep wasting time without seeing the value. We've seen that with some other organizations that we work in, and that's a very common challenge. So how can we help with the challenge? Like from my experience, I think there are two angles to go. First of all, you have to think about your definition of a unit, and then talk with your regulatory framework, like a safety critical buddies internally. What do we define as a unit? So how do we structure that argument? That's the first one. So if you can open up the definition of a unit and get all the regulatory framework buddies agreed to that, then it can actually bring you a lot of benefits, because if your unit is more of like a component base, then you can use the stubs stub configuration to isolate that component more. So that's a more practical approach, in my opinion. And the second thing is coverage. So you can approach it from two ways: unit definition and look at the overall coverage, run the application as is, and see how much coverage your system level tests give you, and structure the argument that the unit tests have been, you have to kind of fulfill that gap with the unit tests. So the combination of the two is a good kind of a first step for addressing that gap. It's a great question, by the way.
Very good. Okay. Dave, we have a softball question for you. Does Parasoft support other testing frameworks, or do I have to use yours?
can't they just use ours? Good question. Interestingly enough, we do support other testing frameworks. Google Test is one that's commonly used. So if you've got tests in place and you want to be able to leverage some of the things that we can do to help automate other portions and facilitate, you know, really good high visibility reporting from what you're doing for testing, and in some cases get much better code coverage, as Andre was referring to, we can work with the existing tests that you have. If you got questions about it, please reach out. Happy to talk to you about your environment and how we could fit in.
Very good. If I mistakenly said where David works, I apologize. Obviously, Dave works for Parasoft. So if I said something incorrectly, I apologize for that. Okay. Andre, if you do not have access to hardware, can I use C++ test with a simulator for unit testing?
Yeah, absolutely. So we support on-target workflow with either, you know, the real hardware in the loop or simulator. Our integration is very flexible, yes.
Okay. Dave from Parasoft. I heard that C++ test product is used for static code analysis, but you talked a lot about unit testing. Is this a different product?
Okay, so yeah, our last session was actually focused entirely on static code analysis and what we could do in MISRA. Our product family for C++ test has options for things that our customers want to enable. In the professional version of our product, static code analysis with flow, support for embedded targets for unit testing and code coverage are all a part of a single product. So there really is one product, one install. The capabilities that are used are simply mitigated through licensing.
Okay, let's see. Another one for you, Dave. Can I use C++ test to follow what you covered in this session, or do I need a specific add-on?
Obviously we were trying to talk about the things that we could do with this product, but it's important to note that some of the dashboards that we saw. So if you want your manager to be able to consume your data, which is still an open question, I think Andre's got some concerns over that, but if you want to be able to quickly and rapidly consume the data that's produced from the testing process, we used a product called Development Testing Platform. We call it DTP. This allows you to create those fancy dashboards. Not only can it integrate with our C++ test family, but it can also integrate with other tools. And has a marketplace which allows for you to download add-ins to other commonly used technology within the software development lifecycle.
Okay. Andre, I see that your tool is TUV certified, so why do I need a qualification kit? Isn't it already approved for ISO 26262?
Yes, actually, it's a good question. In some situations, you do. In some situations, you don't. And the situation depends on all of those very complicated acronyms like TCL level, ACL level, TI. So there are a lot of kind of ingredients or inputs that go into answering that question. But the short answer is it really depends on the module, and it really depends on the level, the TCL level, and the method. So for some of the usages, the TUV certification is enough. For some of the usages, you need to go above and beyond and actually validate the tool for intended use within your environment. And that's where we provide the qualification kit that has the test cases. Remember the slide where it outlined what the qualification kit has, the test cases, the use cases, the required documents, the reports that have to be part of it. So you have to rerun those test cases within your environment and then produce specific documentation.
Okay, we're just about out of time. I got one more here, and let me paraphrase this question, and either of you can answer it. This specs like ISO 26262 are always evolving. How do I be sure that these tools will evolve with the spec?
This is Dave. I'll take that one, and Andre can correct me where I'm wrong. Bottom line is this is important for us, Parasoft's direction for safety critical systems. These are our customers that are following this process. For those of you who know what it takes to get a TÜV certification, it's all done by the vendor, right? So for us to get TÜV certification, it actually means that we have to interact and pay for and submit to a process that gets us that accreditation. So it's in our self-best interest as a company with the customers that we have to follow that. And then two, we have a pretty long practice of following these types of standards. I think we're now on our third TÜV certification process currently. So it's important for Parasoft to remain capable and ready related to these changing requirements.
Okay, I think we're going to wrap here. That's about all we have time for. I certainly want to thank both David and Andre for the great presentations and for their bit of humor, because we all know humor is tough. And certainly we want to thank Parasoft for sponsoring this event. And, of course, we could never do any of these types of events without you, the engineer. A reminder that all Open Systems Media webcasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded without prior permission. So thank you all for attending, and we hope you have a great day.
Thank you.